Looks like we're ready to begin. The assignment that was given to me for this first session, this first week, is the history of the church. It's a good idea to talk about the history. It was Titus Livius, better known as Livy, the Roman historian, who said that the study of history is the best medicine for a sick mind. And it does give us a perspective that we don't get in any other way. Harry Truman said that the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. And Will Durant said that the present is the past rolled up for action. The past is the present unrolled for our understanding. That's well put, and I think rather profound. As we talk about this history, there will be a number of things that should be mentioned, and I hope you'll help me to know what they are. Because it's not like teaching a book of the Bible where you're bound by the text. There's so many things that have happened, and we need to look at the things that we most need to look at. The Lord told us that when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law. Galatians 4:4. God sent His Son when everything was ready. The Greek language was ready, the synagogue was ready, the Roman Empire was ready, its roads were ready, the Pax Romana was ready. And just as Solomon's temple was built out of stone that was made ready elsewhere, and then brought to the site so that no iron tool was heard while it was in building, so the church was meticulously prepared by God through centuries. The prophecies were ready. God had told when and why and where and how this was going to transpire. And on the day the church was supposed to begin, bam, there it was, all ready to go. That little stone cut out of the mountainside without hands was ready to become a mountain that would fill the whole earth. And in one generation, their sound went out into all the earth and their words to the end of the world. Romans 10:18 and Colossians 1:23 tells us that they literally preached the gospel to every creature under heaven. Do you take that literally? I don't know why we shouldn't. That the gospel was preached unto every creature under heaven. I was talking with a man late last week. He said, well, it wasn't taught in North America. I said, well, I'm glad I met you because you're the first person I've ever met who knows that. I don't know that it was not taught in North America. Why do our native cultures have legends about bearded white men who came with special powers? Could those not have been first century Christians with the abilities to perform miracles? I don't say that they were. I don't have that much information. Can you say that they weren't? The gospel was preached to every creature under heaven. So, it's important to understand what the Lord was trying to do. He worked on this for a long time in the manner that He deals with time. He had the language ready. He had the audience ready. Everything was ready. Jesus knew that when His task here was finished, that He must ascend to His Father's right hand and take His seat there. As early as the 6th chapter of Luke, He called to Him His disciples. He chose of them 12, whom He named apostles. Jesus qualified them. He commissioned them for a special function in His body that nobody else has ever fulfilled. He constantly speaks of these apostles as in a class by themselves. They were His special envoys to the world. They were the ones who would sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, Matthew 19:28. They were the ones in Revelation 21:14 who had their names engraved on the 12 foundations of the eternal city, the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 12:28 that God set some in the church first apostles. First from the standpoint of primacy, but first from the standpoint of their authority as well. The apostles of Jesus Christ are plenipotentiary ministers with special powers. The apostolicity of the church is a very important concept. The church is built on the foundation. He set them in the church, and He set them in the foundation. Built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone. Ephesians 2:20. These men could go and make decisions that were binding. It already had been bound in heaven, and through inspiration, they bound it on earth. They could write letters that were authoritative. So we have God, shrouded in His mystery, through the Holy Spirit, He transmits His information to the apostles and prophets, and they, first orally and then in writing, transmitted it to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery. Ephesians chapter 3. They were a very special category of people. Ephesians 4:11 says that the Lord set, He gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some teaching pastors, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of service, for the upbuilding of the body of Christ. By revelation was made known unto me the mystery, which in other ages was not made known unto the sons of men, but is now made known unto His holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit. When this was started in the second chapter of the book of Acts, the Bible gives us the earliest history of the church. The church starts in Acts 2. You can't get any earlier than that. And right from the time it started, we're told that they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. That shows two things. It shows that there was such a thing as the apostles' doctrine, and it shows that it was continued steadfastly in. So Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 1:3, I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus when I went into Macedonia, that thou mightest charge some that they teach no other doctrine. No other doctrine than what? No other doctrine than the apostles' doctrine that Timothy had learned from Paul. Paul had taught the apostles' doctrine in his intensive labors at Ephesus. He left Timothy there to be sure that no other doctrine was taught. This was a constant issue because the same writer Paul said that the mystery of iniquity doth already work. There was already an apostasy coming on while he was writing the New Testament, or writing a great portion of the New Testament as he did. The church would stray from the doctrine of the apostles as the apostasy developed. And that has a lot to do with the history of the church. You know, as the Lord sees it, there's only one church of Christ, one church of Jesus Christ on this earth today. There never has been but one, there never will be but one, but until the Lord shouts and we rise to meet Him in the air, there always will be one. The gates of Hades did not prevail against the establishing of the church, and they will not prevail against the survival of the church. It's never a question of whether you and I are going to keep the church going. The Lord's going to keep it going. The question is whether you and I will assist in that work. If you and I don't do it, the Lord will providentially raise up other people who will, of their own free will, they will. While the earth remains, the Lord is never going to be a king without a subject. He'll never be a shepherd without a sheep. He'll never be a head without a body. He built the church in the year of His crucifixion, and that kingdom of the Messiah shall stand forever. But when we talk about the history of the church, we've got to recognize and keep in the forefront of our minds that ours is an imperfect knowledge. Any group of people can take this book and be the Lord's church by following it. And we won't necessarily know them or know where they are. Nevertheless, the foundation of God standeth sure, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are His. When we talk about the history of the church, that would have, if it's going to be comprehensive, it would have to include the Lord's church in Australia. I don't know very much about the church in Australia. What about the church in North Dakota? I don't know much about the church in North Dakota. Little groups meet in homes. They meet in places where they're not necessarily well known. Like Elijah, it's easy to begin to think that we know more than we really do about these things. But who and where the church is, God knows, primarily. We are as unknown to many of them as they are to us. When we talk about the history of the church beyond that brief period that's given to us in the Bible, and the Bible takes us up to about 100 A.D., then we're talking about information that has been left for us by other people in primary or secondary sources, or things that we ourselves have lived through. In general, the way people get recorded in history books is by somehow attracting attention to themselves. But a well-lived Christian life does not necessarily attract a lot of attention to itself. Sometimes it might. Situations vary. 100 years from now, who's going to know what we were doing here during this meeting? Probably there will be precious little known about that. It may be that this building will be gone. It's already been here 100 years. Will it be here another 100? You've heard prayers that it might be. But we don't know. Most of the houses we live in won't be here in 100 years. Children born today will already be dead, almost without exception, along with everybody older than they are, in 100 years. Nobody with first-hand knowledge of you and me will survive to tell the tale, even just 100 years from now. When we talk about 2,000 years of history, who really knows what all went on? So we have to make this disclaimer at the very beginning, that recorded history is often just a caricature of what really happened. And while we're interested in it and we try to do the best we can with whatever sources we have to understand what happened, we need to understand that what's in a history book may or may not be exactly right. There's a timeline in your notebooks. Historians give differing dates. Usually on that timeline, I use the dates that Brother Brumback gave in his book. But there will be variation from one source to another. I brought something along today that I happen to have in the trunk of my car because you saw pictures of Brother Zur on the screen yesterday. This was Brother Zur's Moshines, History of the Church. At least it was one of his copies. I don't know if he had others or not. But he got this one in 1905 when he was 27 or 28 years of age. In 1929, then he passed it on to L.C. Roberts over in, later on, Brother Roberts lived in Newcastle, Indiana, and that's where I first saw it. Quite a piece of work. Many of those old brethren, you saw both of those men yesterday on the screen. They thoroughly read this and absorbed the contents of this. And they understood, as all of us need to understand, that when we read Mosheim or Schaff or Fisher or Kurtz, any of these histories, that we are reading primarily a history of the apostasy. It's not a history of the Lord's Church at all, with very rare exceptions. Because the Lord's Church, from the beginning, began to move toward the wilderness and spent a lot of time in the wilderness, as it was put in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation. In the wilderness, the apostasy was predicted in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, that there would be a falling away, an apostasia. Paul said to the Ephesian elders that of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them. He said later that in the latter time some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry. You know these passages. That there would be an apostasy. The book of Jude has been referred to as the Acts of the Apostates. He talks there about certain men who have crept in unawares, and this was happening all over the place. The great apostasy was the result of a gradual departure, in fact, many threads of gradual departure from the spirit and truth of the faith. This can be painful to talk about, especially if you have certain backgrounds. Sometimes when I've talked about this, I've had people say to me, especially if they were from other backgrounds, "Rick, I know what you say is true. I know it needs to be said, but it still kind of stings when I hear you say it." And I want to be sympathetic to that. I want to be sensitive to it, and I want to speak the truth, but I want to speak the truth in love. Sometimes we can give things up intellectually a long time before we can give them up emotionally. Sometimes if we have family ties to to various apostate traditions. We love our families, we love our parents who reared us, and it hurts to think about the truth of some of these issues. Sometimes it takes a while for our hearts to catch up with our head. We all need to receive into our own hearts the love of the truth and to follow truth wherever it leads. David said, "I hate every false way." And we each need to hate every false way. This is a copy of Brother Brumback's History of the Church. I think so much of this that I used to get a hold of these by the box and give them to people that I thought should have them. I don't know how to get these nice hardback copies like that anymore. Maybe you do. But this is the last one I have, and I don't expect to leave Nixa with it. So if you know somebody that's deserving of it, let me know, and we'll just give this to them. Jeff, do you have one of these? Good. Well, I just happened to see him sitting there, and I thought he would be a deserving prospect. Jay, I hope you're getting to know Jeff. He came to us from the Roman Catholic background a number of years ago, and he came as a searcher of truth. And no, it was not just because of that girl, although she was instrumental in this. But he has demonstrated a growth and development over the years that's just remarkable, I think. Brother Brumback, I wish you all could have known him. Amen. He was on the screen yesterday, and it just sort of made my eyes mist up as I saw that picture of him. But if you'd known him, you'd be as old as Tom and I are. He died when I was young. I can remember being in his home, playing with his grandson, seeing his slides of Israel. He did a great deal of research into the history of the church and the apostasy. He lectured about it for years, refining his material, and then he compiled what he had learned into this book in 1957. And if I can inspire just one person to read that, you know, I know people who've had this on their shelf for 55 years and have yet to read it. If I can inspire in this class just one person to read this book of history, I'll feel good about that, because this deserves reading. You can say that it's not written the very best. You can say that the footnotes aren't in the form where you can easily look things up. Those things could be true. But it's still a remarkable piece of work, and nobody has superseded it since his time. And I highly recommend it. We are told in the book of Hebrews, chapter 13, verse 7, "Remember those who have spoken unto you the word of the Lord, whose faith follow, considering the purpose of their behavior." Our brother labored hard and long over this. He died at a rather early age, what's looking earlier and earlier, the older I get. He wasn't a very old man when he passed on. But he put a lot of himself into this, and it repays careful and repeated reading. And I just feel like we're letting a resource that we have slip by if we don't pay close attention to what he said here. Of course, check it out. Obviously, that's what the footnotes are for. But be sure before you disagree with him that you've checked your facts well, because he checked them, and he checked them consistently over time. Many of the dates on the timeline in your notebooks came directly out of this book, and I could even give you page numbers where those dates are mentioned if you're interested in that. But I like this book because the nice thing about it is that you never get bogged down, even if you hate history. It's written in short little segments, perfectly written in that way for the person who is new to the subject or not real interested in the subject. It's a tremendous overview of the history of the church. I want to read you a little poem as we talk about the early years of the church. We have to start talking about the apostles almost instantly. I mean, the apostates almost instantly, because the change began to take place very rapidly. This poem is called The Calf Path. Some of you have heard it and read it in other sources. But I think it well depicts what happened to the Lord's church. And it happened really by a lot of well-meaning people. These were not people who were trying to lead the church astray, and I think that's important to notice. Some of them were, but a lot of them weren't. Whether they were or weren't, the result was what we have today, a mix-mash, a hodgepodge that's almost unbelievable in our time. And it all started out from that day of Pentecost. This poem was written by Sam Walter Foss, and it's called The Calf Path. One day, through a primeval wood, a calf walked home, as good calves should, but made a trail all bent askew, a crooked trail, as all calves do. Since then, 200 years have fled, and I infer the calf is dead. But still, he left behind his trail, and thereby hangs my moral tale. The trail was taken up next day by a lone dog that passed that way. And then a wise bellwether sheep pursued the trail o'er vale and steep and drew the flock behind him too, as good bellwethers always do. And from that day o'er hill and glade through those old woods a path was made. And many men wound in and out and dodged and turned and bent about and uttered words of righteous wrath because 'twas such a crooked path. But still they followed, do not laugh, the first migrations of that calf. And through the winding woodways stalked, because he wobbled when he walked. The forest path became a lane that bent and turned again. The crooked lane became a road where many a poor horse with his load toiled on beneath the burning sun, and traveled some 3 miles in one. And thus, a century and a half, they trod the footsteps of that calf. The years passed on in swiftness fleet. The road became a village street, and this, before men were aware, a city's crowded thoroughfare, and soon the central street was this of a renowned metropolis, and men 2 centuries and a half trod in the footsteps of that calf. Each day 100,000 rout followed the zigzag calf about, and o'er his crooked journey went the traffic of a continent. 100,000 men were led by one calf near 3 centuries dead. They followed still his crooked way and lost 100 years a day. For thus such reverence is lent to well-established precedent. A moral lesson this might teach, were I ordained and called to preach, for men are prone to go it blind along the calf paths of the mind and work away from sun to sun to do what other men have done. They follow in the beaten track, and out and in and forth and back, and still their devious course pursue to keep the path that others do. But how the wise old wood gods laugh who saw that first primeval calf. Ah, many things this tale might teach, but I am not ordained to preach. The apostasy was such an insidious development that no one generation saw anything but a small fragment of it during their lifetime. Incremental change away from the doctrine of the apostles resulted in what we see today. But it took hundreds and hundreds of years for this to fully develop. I'd like to show you, if I can, from the very early times, just one little segment of how this apostasy got going. And to do this, I'm going to refer back to a group of writers known as the Apostolic Fathers. I'll just write that up here if I can. I'll put that in quotation marks. As far as I know, they weren't called apostolic fathers until about the 17th century, but they're well known by this today. They're not on your chart there, but you can put them on there if you want to. They lived and wrote in the last half of the first century and the first half of the second century. And if the church was started around 30 AD, then what we're saying here is that the apostolic fathers wrote within the first 120 years of Christian history. Even though they weren't called apostolic fathers until the late 17th century, and even though a lot of their writings were lost and have only been recently rediscovered, they were actually in the very early years. They're called apostolic fathers because some of them lived at the time when it was still possible to have personal contact with an apostle of Christ or two, and to know them in the flesh. I have to say on this that, speaking strictly for myself, the idea of the Apostolic Fathers is a lot more interesting than the actual texts of the Apostolic Fathers. It's important when we talk about that we talk about this, because this material does exist and we ought to be somewhat conversant with it. But the material itself is not particularly important, I don't think. In fact, I have to confess to you that I find some of the Apostolic Fathers well nigh unreadable. And I don't know that there's any particular reason why we ought to make a great effort to read it. The parts of the Apostolic Fathers that agree with the Bible seem all too obvious. The parts that don't agree with the Bible seem all too bizarre. And the parts that agree with the Bible we don't need, because we already have the Bible. And the parts that don't agree with the Bible are just curiosities or something worse than that. The Apostolic Fathers make the Bible look delightfully simple and clear by contrast. I heard about one man who, it was said of him that he doesn't like to read, and then I found out he was reading the Apostolic Fathers, and I thought, well, the Apostolic Fathers could validate anybody's dislike of reading. If you're interested in this material, if you're interested in it, and by the way, I brought along a copy of that. You can borrow this if you want to. It's got them all right in here. Very standard copy of it. If you haven't read it and you want to read it, then by all means read it. But I hope your expectations of it are not too high. If you're not interested in it, I don't know of any reason that you should force yourself to, unless it's just in preparation for something. Some things we just read to see what's there, and maybe especially what's not there. So you might want to just scan or skim it, remembering the words of Francis Bacon, that some books are to be tasted, others are to be swallowed, and some few books are to be chewed and digested. Some of these are very early writings. The Didache, for example, the text was lost and it wasn't rediscovered until 1873. That's just the Greek New Testament word for teaching. This is the teaching. It's a rudimentary manual of church order compiled in the first century. It's mentioned and quoted by lots of other writers, so I know that many of you have heard from it. We knew that it existed before we found it again. It wasn't even published in the English language until 1883. It's only 7 pages long. But the reason I mention the Didache, which means teaching, the Didache of the Apostles, the teaching of the Apostles is what it's called, is that this is still early enough that in the Didache, the word bishop is still used to be synonymous with presbyter, just like it is in the New Testament. In the New Testament, you get 6 words: bishop and overseer, elder and presbyter, shepherd and pastor, and they all refer to the same people. These are just different descriptions of the men who have this one job. You're very well familiar with this material. But as we look at documents written a little later than the Didache, we see that the bishop is regarded as being over the presbyters as the great apostasy begins to make its inroads into the government of the church. So the Didache is important for this one reason to me, that it still has the bishops and the presbyters being the same people. And that's all. I'm not going to talk about many of the Apostolic Fathers, just the ones that seem relevant to this idea of the apostasy. I'm going to move on to Ignatius here. Ignatius is a very interesting character. And he had 7 letters in the writings of the Apostolic Fathers, written while he was on his way to be martyred. They took him to Rome to be martyred. At 2 different stopping places along the way, he wrote letters. Wrote 4 letters from Smyrna, where Polycarp lived. And Ignatius was staying there and in personal communication with Polycarp. And then his 3 remaining letters were written later from Troas, where his party had stopped again for a while, before crossing the sea for Europe to go to Rome, where he was going to be killed. The place of writing in every case is determined by the statements that are in these epistles that he wrote. And I don't want to go into those in a great deal of detail. The reason for mentioning them at all in the context of the history of the church, well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that Ignatius is very concerned about the Gnostics. I was asked in my assignment to look at the issues individuals faced during each period. This was one of the great issues of the early church, Gnosticism. And we've had classes on that before. Several people that are here have taught classes about Gnosticism. I don't intend to go into all that again, but we should be aware that it was already in the New Testament. Paul is fighting it in the Colossian letter. The Apostle John is fighting it in his epistles, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. This is why the emphasis on the fact that Jesus came in the flesh. The Docetists, whom Ignatius is particularly concerned about, taught that Jesus did not come in the flesh, that he only appeared to be here in the flesh. But if Jesus stepped in the mud, he wouldn't leave a footprint, that you could try to take a hold of Jesus and pass your hand right through it. This is why the Apostle John emphasizes the fact that our hands have handled him, lived with him for 3.5 years. I've touched this man. Mary touched him. You know, Jesus said, don't hang on to me. Don't cling, keep hold, grasping onto me. He could be touched. He was here in the flesh. And the Gnostics, especially the Docetics, which were a branch of the Gnostics, were denying this. They denied the actual incarnation of Jesus, believing that he only seemed to possess a human nature and a human body. Well, Ignatius said, if Jesus only appeared to suffer, then I'm going to Rome to die for nothing. And of course, that would have been true. It's the reality of the incarnation, he says, that makes it incumbent on Christians to take seriously their own bodies and present them as a living sacrifice, and to take seriously the bodily needs of others, and also to take the Lord's Supper seriously and the body of the church. Keep your flesh as the temple of God. This is all based on the fact that Jesus was incarnated and took on flesh as we are. So he has quite a lot to say about this, but the reason I really wanted to mention Ignatius to you is that he's worried that anything's going to disrupt the unity of the church. But for him, that meant that somebody might do something apart from the authority of the bishop. Because by this time, and this is early in the second century, the Apostle John's only been dead just a little while. The book of Revelation, the ink on it is dry, but it hasn't been dry for long. And already, Ignatius is referring to a hierarchy. You've got a bishop, and then under the bishop in the congregation, you've got presbyters and deacons. This is a critically important issue, and it seems it's hard for people to get this. Saturday night, I was talking to a man on the streets of Springfield. I went looking for a restaurant, and I never did find it, but while I was looking for it, it was one I'd eaten with my daughter and son-in-law at one point, and I was trying to find it again. Never found the restaurant, but I found a guy on the street with some signs. There were a bunch of them on the corners down there. A lot of people going by, and they had these signs up with messages about the end of the world and biblical-type messages. So I got talking to them. And they're a very interesting group. They call themselves the Church of Monette. Is anybody familiar with them? Oh, what do you know, Sarah? I thought they were very interesting people. Monette's probably 45 miles that direction, if I'm pointing the right way. Yeah, okay. They call themselves that, but they take a fairly biblical approach to things. And we were comparing issues. I must have stood there and talked with them for a couple of hours. It was really weird. I'll just tell you this as well, based on Eric's talk yesterday morning. They were holding up these signs, and all these people were going by with this hate speech toward these people. I mean, really, I can't repeat what was being said to these people on a regular basis as people walked by. And then one old gal came by, and as she was saying her vituperations, I smelled her breath, and I then understood. This is being fueled by alcohol. These people have their inhibitions are way down, and that's why they're saying all these things. And so yesterday when Eric was talking about they had been with Jesus and how we ought to react to the world around us, I thought about not being drunk with wine, but being filled with the Spirit. Maybe that ought to decrease our inhibitions too. And we can talk with these people. I was running interference between these two groups for a little while there. Seriously, it's very interesting when people try to talk about the Bible, but they're not as clear on it as you are. One lady was saying that Paul cut somebody's ear off. You know. type of thing. Very interesting. But anyway, the reason I started into to this about the Church of Monette, talking about all this biblical stuff, how we follow the Bible, but I noticed he kept referring back to the anti-Nicene fathers, the so-called church fathers that wrote before the Council of Nicaea in 325, which is on your timeline there. The ones before that, they felt like are the pure ones, and they kept referring to this. He said, oh, I'm reading Irenaeus Against Heresies, and they kept referring to this for the way things ought to do, the way the church ought to do things. I said, do you believe that the anti-Nicene fathers are authoritative? Oh, no. Just the Bible is authoritative. But the anti-Nicene fathers tell us how things were done. And he said, now there's our pastor over there on the corner. He can tell you. I said, you're what? How many pastors do you have? Well, we just got the one. You know, we're a small group. I said, well, what do you feel about the... Do you think a pastor and an elder are the same thing to begin with? Oh, yes, I believe that. How many what do you think about the plurality of elders? And we talked about that for a while. He wasn't so sure that you had to have the plurality of elders, although he said he believed in it. He also baptized for the remission of sins, but he said if we never get a certain person into the water, they're still saved. How can that be? So you can see why I just lingered there and looked into this more and more. But it's hard to get people to talk about the appointing of a plurality of elders to serve equal in authority, equal in responsibility over a single congregation. That's difficult to do, even when you've got people who are trying to. They sounded to me like they came kind of out of an Anabaptist position. And a little Mennonite influence in there as well. But they had this pastor, and they weren't really interested in a plurality of elders, although this man I was talking to said that he believed in it. The thing that had happened here already in the time of Ignatius was a remarkable change. He says in one of his letters, this is his letter to the Ephesians, your honorable presbytery, now the New Testament uses the word presbytery, it means a group of elders. Neglect not the gift of his... Paul says that Timothy had the laying on of the hands of the presbytery, a group of elders. Timothy's elders laid hands on him for some reason. Next week, Lord willing, if you'll come back, we'll talk about the reason that they laid their hands on him. Paul laid his hands on Timothy too. But it was a different thing than when the presbytery laid their hands on Timothy. Your honorable presbytery, your group of elders, is attuned to the bishop even as it strings to a lyre. L-Y-R-E. Just as the strings are attuned to the musical instrument called a lyre, so your presbytery, your elders, are attuned to the bishop. They had a bishop over them by this time. And he goes on and on. This is one of the main points that he makes in letter after letter about following the bishop. Everybody needs to follow the bishop. He said in the letter to the Trallians, in this matter, let all men respect the deacons as Jesus Christ, even as they respect the bishop as being a type of the Father, and the presbyters as the council of God and as the college of the apostles. So the bishop is like God, and the presbyters are underneath the bishop like the apostles by the time of Ignatius. This is early 2nd century. No wonder Paul said the mystery of iniquity doth already work. This is major when you change the government of the church in this way. I'll read you one more, although there are many others that we could turn to. This is from Ignatius to the Smyrnans. He wrote four letters from Smyrna, and then he went to Troas and wrote back to the Smyrnans. Follow your bishop as Jesus Christ followed the Father, and the presbytery as the apostles. Let no man do aught of things pertaining to the church apart from the bishop. And then he goes on in every sentence here. It's the bishop, the bishop. It is not lawful apart from the bishop either to baptize or to hold a love feast. He that honoreth the bishop is honored of God. We could go on and on with this, but I hope that's enough to make that point, that there has been a substantial change very early in the government of the church. Nobody has the right to change the government of the church. God knew what he wanted. He set it up exactly the way he wanted. And like Ted said yesterday, really, Ted's lesson yesterday was my whole 2 weeks of meeting in capsule form. Ted said yesterday, when God wants us to know something, he tells us. and he gave us all the information we need for the church in the New Testament. We had a multiplicity of bishops, presbyters involved there in the church. Well, this is a very important change and a very early change that we see at the time of the Apostolic Fathers. We mentioned the Gnosticism that Ignatius was talking about here. Very early we were having Gnostic Gospels be produced that are confusing the issue in our day. They weren't really confusing it until the Da Vinci Code came out a few years ago. But since that time, people are aware that these Gospels exist. The Da Vinci Code, the statement was made in the Da Vinci Code that it was made by a man who's supposed to know what he's talking about and is authoritative. The statement was made there that Constantine had 80 Gospels to pick from. And he picked the four that he wanted and put them in the Bible. There are so many things wrong with that statement that we won't even take the time to unravel it. But you are definitely aware by now of these Gnostic Gospels. When people hear about the Gnostic Gospels, they think of Gospels. They haven't read them, the Gnostic Gospels, and they're not about to actually read them themselves in most cases. And so when they just hear about them, they think of Gospels like we have in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But these Gnostic Gospels, so-called, are not like that at all. If you want to read about those, you've got the Nag Hammadi Scriptures right here. These Nag Hammadi Scriptures were found in 1945 down in the middle part of Egypt, dug up out of the ground. And a lot of these things existed way, way, way back. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Judas, which we just have had now for, 6 years or so? We haven't had that one for very long. But every time something like this comes about, there's a great stir over it, and it's thought, oh, this is going to rock the Christian world to its foundation because we're getting information that we didn't have before. Well, no, we're not. This is second century rubbish, and it's still rubbish in the 21st century. I don't know why that's so hard for people to see, but they get the impression. What Dan Brown did in the Da Vinci Code was develop a conspiracy theory. Everybody loves a good conspiracy theory. And I think that's what's really at work here. That the idea is that these Gnostic Gospels are being kept from you. This is what the church, whatever that means in that context, the church doesn't want you to know about this. So here's some hidden knowledge. And that's been the hallmark of Gnosticism from the very beginning, that this is only for the elite. It's only for the initiates. The gnosis is the word for knowledge. And we're the ones who have the special knowledge, and we're willing to impart it to you if you'll come with us. But the hoi polloi, they don't know about this. They're just a bunch of dumb sheep. So that's the idea here, that there's a conspiracy theory to keep you away from this. We'll let you in on it if you're good. But I think that's one reason that people like to be confused about religion, and therefore they don't have to make a decision or a commitment. So that's involved here as well. There's a lot we could say about those Gnostic Gospels, but I don't know that this is the time or place for that. Just know that they were around from a very early time and were confusing people from a very early time. Ignatius was very concerned about Gnosticism. Also, around this time, we have Polycarp, whom I mentioned, but I'll put his name up here. Polycarp. Is very famous to us because he was from Smyrna, and we have a letter from the Lord to Smyrna in the second chapter of the book of Revelation. Really, Polycarp, I think, again, is more interesting as a man and as a martyr than he is as a writer, but we do have something from Polycarp in the Apostolic Fathers. The time of his martyrdom was probably Saturday, February the 23rd, 155 A.D. And at that time, Polycarp claimed to have been serving Christ for 86 years. That's in the martyrdom of Polycarp, chapter 9, verse 3. I don't know whether it meant that he was 86 years old or that it had been 86 years since his baptism, but either way, he had some age on him by that time. This means that his life did not merely reach back to apostolic times. We also know that he was personally acquainted with the Apostle John and with others who had seen the Lord. Tertullian cites a tradition of the church at Smyrna to the effect that Polycarp was appointed to the eldership by the Apostle John himself. That may or may not be true. I like to believe it, but I couldn't prove it. But there is a tradition to that effect. Irenaeus treasured a vivid memory of having seen and heard Polycarp when Irenaeus himself was just a child in Asia Minor. He tells how Polycarp talked about his own memories of the first generation of believers who had seen the Lord. This is really interesting because of his longevity. Polycarp serves as a bridge between the apostolic age of the church and the Catholic orthodoxy of the latter part of the second century. It wasn't Roman Catholic yet. It would become that later. But it was Catholic in the sense of the what was becoming the universal orthodoxy in the latter part of the second century. One of Polycarp's stories about the Apostle John portrays the Apostle John finding an early Gnostic heretic named Cerinthus in the baths one day. Back in those days, they didn't have bathtubs in their houses for the most part, and so they had public baths that were often in the middle of the street, and there would be walls around them. There would be some privacy, but people would go into these public baths to get cleaned. And the Apostle John went in there to take his bath, but he saw Cerinthus in there, this Gnostic heretic. So without lingering to take his own bath, John said to his friends, paraphrasing, "Let's get out of here in case the building collapses, because the enemy of truth, Cerinthus, is in here." On one another occasion, Polycarp met Marcion, who was a heretic of his own day. And Marcion wanted to be recognized and acknowledged by Polycarp. So Polycarp said, "I recognize you as the firstborn of Satan." Very shortly before his martyrdom, Polycarp went to Rome to see who was the one who is now known as Pope Anicetus. He wasn't a pope in the universal sense because the universal papacy was yet unknown. But it's really interesting. It's kind of ironic. This little book, the Oxford Dictionary of Popes, is very valuable if you want just a little bit of information about each one of the popes. It goes from the Apostle Peter, who was the first pope according to this tradition, as you well know, and comes right on down to Benedict the 16th, who is the present pope. So there's a little bit of information about each one. There's even a vignette about the female pope here and a bunch of anti-popes as well. So it's very interesting, stretches for 2,000 years. But I was going to read to you a little bit about Anicetus when Polycarp went to see him. This is on page 10. He received a visit from Polycarp, the octogenarian bishop of Smyrna, who, after they had reached agreement on other issues, tried to persuade him to adopt the practice of the churches of Asia Minor of observing Easter on the 14th, the day of the Passover. At this time, the Roman church did not have a special Easter festival. Do you hear that? At this time, the Roman church did not have a special Easter festival. Anicetus felt obliged to abide by his predecessor's custom of celebrating the Lord's resurrection every Sunday. So here you have Polycarp trying to get the Pope to apostatize. A very, very interesting turn of events there. We got one letter from Polycarp that survives. It's addressed to the Ephesians. It's 5 pages long in translation. There's nothing there really to note. I'll just conclude here, since I'm starting to run out of time, with the martyrdom of Polycarp, because it's more interesting than anything that he ever wrote that has come down to us. Polycarp, through the urging of his friends, had been persuaded to leave the city of Smyrna where he was and take refuge in the country because he knew that they were after him. He was the bishop of the church by this time. An armed band of soldiers came and seized him. It was late on a Friday night. The old man was calmly asleep in his room. He was wakened by the noise of their entrance. He came down. He greeted the soldiers kindly. He offered them a meal. He asked the soldiers if he might be permitted to pray for 1 hour undisturbed before they took him away. The soldiers were impressed by his age and his kindness. They granted him permission, and at the end of the hour, they conducted him into the city of Smyrna. Many of the pagans who had known Polycarp for a long time and liked him entreated him, "Just say Lord Caesar and sacrifice. Just say Lord Caesar and sacrifice and save your life." He merely said, "I cannot follow your advice." He was taken to the stadium where the games were going on. He was brought before the tribunal of the proconsul Philip, who seemed to wish to save the old man. "If you will merely swear by Caesar and reproach Christ, I will immediately release you." Polycarp, this is when he said, 86 years have I served him, and he never did me wrong. How can I now blaspheme my king who saved me? I am a Christian. If you wish to learn the Christian doctrine, grant me a day, and I will declare it to you." And so when Polycarp refused to comply with the proconsul's request, he was first threatened with being cast to wild beasts, and then he was threatened with being burned alive. He answered, "You threaten with fire that burns for a moment and is soon extinguished, for you know nothing of the judgment to come and the fire of eternal punishment reserved for the wicked." The government was astonished at these words. He sent a herald to proclaim in the middle of the stadium, "Polycarp professes that he is a Christian. He confesses that he is a Christian." The crowd forthwith collected wood and straw from the shops and baths, especially the Jews who were against the church. As usual, they offered their services for this purpose, and they broke their own Sabbath day in order to go around and collect this fodder for the fire. They formed a pile of fuel around Polycarp, and they were at the point of securing him to the stake by spikes. He asked that they not nail him to the stake. He promised that he would make no effort to move away from the fire. That's why they didn't kill him, but they merely bound him to the stake. He was thrust through with a sword later, and his body was consigned to the flames, as I said, on Saturday, February the 23rd, 155 A.D. He was burned and killed, thrust through with a sword, killed in this way for believing basically what you and I believe today.